when we become ill, what is the message of this illness? What is it? Am I really depleted from giving too much to others and not paying attention to my own well-being, to the things that put a light in my own eyes? That's a big change. And, you know, I help people set up these selfish bitch projects, because to set up a new life where you actually honor what your body needs, when you honor what well-being is for you, that feels really selfish initially. And it's not, it's just a misunderstanding. And so knowing how to invest in your own well-being, so you create this surplus of well-being in us, that creates a wealth internally that you can just enjoy your life.
Welcome to the Global Wellness Summit podcast. I'm your host, Kim Marshall, the co-founder of Swell the Agency, and as I often say, a wellness storyteller. And boy, do we have a story today. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be in the catbird seat and talk to such a wide array of thought leaders in the wellness space. But just listen who we're chatting with today. He's a Harvard professor, a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, and a theologian, all in one person. We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Rediger, the author of the unforgettable book, Cured, The Life-Changing Science of Spontaneous Healing. Dr. Rediger is also a keynote speaker at the upcoming Global Wellness Summit being held November 30 to December 3 at the Encore Boston Harbor. And how fitting, since the theme of the summit is a new era in health and wellness, and the focus will be on a future where wellness takes a much bigger role in medicine and science takes a much bigger role in wellness. Dr. Rediger, who was actually raised in an Amish community, has been called a leading voice challenging current healthcare systems and treatment models. And a quick sampling of his book review shows why. A professor of psychology at Harvard wrote that Dr. Rediger's nearly two decades of work chronicled in the book shows that we may have far more control over our health than most physicians, researchers, and the lay public realize. The author of The Body Keeps Score says, "This is a hopeful tale of how through resilience and meaningful lifestyle adjustments, even the most serious of cases can be redeemed." But my biggest takeaways from speaking with Dr. Rediger are his humanity, his humility, his kindness, and his belief in a medicine of hope and healing. Please enjoy our conversation. See if you just don't gain a greater appreciation for our amazing body and minds' ability to heal. All right, my friend, today we have a real treat for everyone. It's a sneak preview of the stunning and fabulous topics that we'll be discussing at the Global Wellness Summit in Boston, November 30 to December 3rd. The theme of the conference is a new era in health and wellness, and nobody embodies that better than our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Rediger, MD. Wait till you hear who he is. Ready? Just buckle your seatbelt, because I was feeling like I accomplished a few things in my life until I read his bio. Here you go. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of the McLean Adult Psychiatry and Community Affairs Region or Department of the McLean Hospital in Boston. He's a licensed physician and board-certified psychiatrist. Okay, that's enough. But he has his Master of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. So you talk about mind, body, soul. This man has us covered. Now, he has spent nearly two decades researching the journey of individuals who've recovered from incurable illnesses. His work has been featured on popular outlets like The Oprah Winfrey Show, Dr. Oz, and Goop. And many of these stories are featured in his best-selling book, Cured, Strengthen Your Immune System and Heal Your Life. Dr. Rediger, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. I just can't wait to get you sharing your wisdom with us. But this is the Global Wellness Summit podcast. So we celebrate the research, the findings, and the presentations of its sister organization, the Global Wellness Institute. But we also focus on the work of the presenters at each year's summit. You know, this year we're going to talk a lot about the developments in mental wellness and the human and economic cost of not focusing on prevention. But you know, your work of about two decades takes that a step further and focuses not only on what makes people sick, but what makes them heal. Please tell us what that really means.
Well, that's a great question. I think it's been a shocking discovery for me to realize that as a physician, I was trained to make a diagnosis and start a medication. But by and large, we don't study at all how people heal. And so it took me a long time listening to these remarkable stories to really get it about what that means. I view modern medicine as brilliant in some ways and broken in other ways. And an analogy that makes sense to me is that modern medicine is like a long line of ambulances at the bottom of a tall cliff. And so we have these ambulances that are great and whisk people away who have fallen off the cliff to our hospitals and our clinics and do a great job of repairing what happens. But what would happen if we put guardrails at the top of the cliff so that people wouldn't fall off in the first place? That would be a completely different kind of medicine. 85 to 90% of what people suffer from is their lifestyle illnesses. And in medical school, I was taught that these are genetic, but they have a genetic basis perhaps. But now we know that genes get turned on and off by lifestyle, by nutrition, by how we feel about ourselves and the universe at a deep level. And so the major killers, heart disease, diabetes, lung disease, autoimmune illness, cancer, these are lifestyle illnesses by and large. And so if they're created by lifestyle, they can be reversed. And so there's a lot to that. And I don't want to minimize the challenges around that, but by and large, as docs, we're taught to just start people on medications and we treat them as incurable and they're not. And so it's a different way of thinking. And we need to open an era like global wellness has been looking at for a long time about what it means to create health and well-being and to study how people heal.
Well, we want to welcome you to our tribe ahead of time, Dr. Bettinger, because you'll see this is where you belong. We're so tickled to have you. You know, I want to congratulate you on your efforts to spread the good word. Clearly, I'm a believer in podcasts, but I think you are too. You've been on so many and also interviewed in TV and publications. One phrase I keep seeing on your website and interviews is hope and healing, and that your medicine is one of hope and possibility. I mean, you know, you have so many degrees. You're a psychiatrist, a medical doctor, and a theologian. You could be so ego-driven. Let me let you in on that secret. Instead, what do you think has made you, to me, so positive and kind?
Well, I think life throws all of us curves. And this has been a very personal and professional journey for me. I didn't go into this work with plans to create a career. This was a personal need to find and figure out what was true. And, you know, I come from a rural background. My father was in the Amish tradition. We left all of that when I was 2 years old. And I grew up in a home that was very religious, but also very violent and very shame-based. And that was very difficult for me. And the conservatism was really challenging. And so I was at home in a world where TV, radio, even store-bought clothes, there's a lot of concern about the worldliness of these things, and then going to public school during the day and exposed to a very different world, science and things. And so going back and forth between the two cultures of school and home was challenging for me, trying to figure out what was true and to figure out how to deal with the pain and confusion I had. And so going to college and then finding wonderful teachers and mentors and beginning to really work on these questions. And then these questions deepened in my study in seminary in an effort to just figure out what's true. And then becoming convinced in seminary that medical school, that science is not a tool of the devil, that evolution is not a bad thing. And convinced me that medical school was a great next step to keep exploring my questions. And so it's been a very personal journey. And I think a physician who's been on both sides of understanding what it means to struggle, and it makes it more than just a professional thing.
I'm sort of cranky about you because you have so much content out there to review. and I could use a week to do it. And you've been on so many, you know, interview stages, you might say. What still surprises you about the reactions to what you're sharing with interviewers? What has been like, oh, I didn't know they'd react that way?
I think one of the bigger things is that, you know, when you talk about what it takes to heal a mind and a life and a body, absolutely, we talk about things like nutrition. We talk about what it means to heal a stress response, to heal the immune system. But the thing that both the people that I've been interviewing for these last 19 years or so, and also people that write emails to me about their response to the book, it's these later chapters where we talk about what it means to heal one's beliefs, to wake up to one's value, to recognize that, you know, we all grow up and we pick up beliefs from our parents, from kids on the playground, from bosses, from teachers, from our peers. Some of these beliefs are true and some of them are false. Some of them are conscious, some are unconscious. But I've really come to understand increasingly that if we carry a mixed set of beliefs through our life, we will have mixed results in our mind and our body and our life. And just to see and feel the power of that as people begin to liberate themselves from some of these false beliefs that we carry around and begin to see ourselves with compassion, to experience our value, to begin to set up a life and make the very difficult, messy choices that set up a life that honors what you bring into the world. It's an astonishing thing to watch and a privilege to hear these stories.
See what I mean about him being so kind? I love it. We're going to get way deep into that. But, you know, I should tell you first that you and I have a few things in common. One is I was raised in a very religious household too. I was able to watch TV and listen to radio and wear store-bought clothes. But there were some similarities. You know, my sister married into a family that lives in an Amish community in Ohio. Were you born in Ohio or Pennsylvania? Which one?
Actually, northeast Indiana, so not far from Ohio. I worked in Pennsylvania at a Mennonite psychiatric hospital. So,
well, for those who don't know, Amish are the ones who they don't use electricity, horse and buggy. They're back in time, but there is a challenge in that community too. And I'm sure you saw those paradoxes. But my sister said there is a new book called The Amish Paradox, and it shows an Amish girl with the bonnet and the, you know, homemade dress with a cell phone. You know, she's on the cell phone.
Right. Right.
And her husband is a farmer and a builder and all. So he's always at the feed stores. And he said, it's so funny to see all the Amish cell phones plugged in because they don't have electricity at home. So they charge them at the store. But we will get into that. She worked at a Mennonite restaurant. And oh my God, did she gain a few pounds. I was like, what are you doing, honey? Get off the banana cream pie or whatever it was. But, you know, another thing we have in common, speaking of hope and possibility, is really believing in the body's power to heal itself. I was lucky enough to spend the majority of my career in the spa industry. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but at its core, it's about hope and taking responsibility for your own well-being. It's about proactive wellness and joyful longevity. We often call destination spas, which is a place where you go, all you do is spa. And it's really built around fitness, nutrition, and body and mind therapies. We call those destination spas a place you go for an annual tune-up. You know, it's actually like hospitals for healthy people.
Yes.
Because, you know, people usually spend more time maintaining their cars than their own bodies. Is that a similar approach to what you see as the role that doctors should play?
Well, I think, yes, completely. I think that doctors should be viewed as coaches and someone who can help you get in touch with the deeper causes of what's going on in your life and in your body, and not as the experts on your life and body, but someone who you see for 15 minutes at a time, maybe once a month or once a year or every several months. And so doctors, yes, coaches, but you know, every person knows things about their life and their body, and they need to be encouraged to bring that into the clinical situation. As doctors, we're taught to actually exclude the patient's story from because we're taught to eliminate the story in order to get through to the underlying signs and symptoms of illness and how that is distinguished from different illnesses. And the story holds everything. The story holds the possibilities of healing and what the deeper causes are. So absolutely, I agree with what you're saying.
Well, you know,
this goes hand in hand with, I remember a mind-blowing presentation at the Global Wellness Summit 2017 in Palm Beach. It was a Harvard researcher who studied the placebo effect.
Right.
And we've all heard of it, but do we really know that many times it's kind of neck and neck with medicine and the results it comes, it brings about. So tell me, how does the placebo effect align with your work?
Well, and I write about this in Cured. It's a massive issue because we typically ignore the placebo effect, but it's huge. So for example, this amazing lady, Dr. Marcia Engel, this woman was finally, she was the first editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. And as editor-in-chief, she began to become concerned about this trifecta of industry and industry pays the academics to get the certain results in their studies and how that interacts with government and lobbyists and the recommendations made, whether it's about food or pharmaceuticals. And so, you know, pharmaceuticals are important and I prescribe them every day, but it's a complicated area. And so she did a meta-analysis over all the studies that had been done on depression that had been done and realized that 50% of all the studies had been done on medicines for depression, 50% of those placebo was as strong as or stronger than the treatment.
Come on.
And 50%. But the thing that really got her concerned was that the 50% of studies where placebo was as strong or stronger than the medication, they weren't published. And so only the ones that get the results that the pharmaceutical companies wanted were getting published. And so she really began to have a change of heart about, as a scientist, really concerned about this. And so she still, very much as a scientist, she believes in science, she believes there's an important role for medications, but also really understands that placebo is a massive issue and we can't just ignore this or publish the results that are what we want. And so that's one thing. And I talk in Cured about this really famous study that was also published in the New England Journal of Medicine, large study, very well done. And they took these people who had knee pain, and arthroscopy is a $1 billion industry in terms of these knee surgeries that are done every year.
Right, right.
And they had the control group didn't get the surgery, did not get the arthroscopy. They just were put to sleep, had a little incision made over their knee, and then were treated as if they'd had the surgery, and versus the treatment group, which got the arthroscopy surgery. There's no difference in the results.
Come on.
People had the same relief from pain, and that relief from pain persisted over a period or long period of time. And so we still do this arthroscopy surgeries all the time. But this is a really well done study that shows that placebo is a lot bigger deal than we realize. So, there's a lot to this.
And the mind having the effect on the body, the mind-body connection. I mean, you know, in my work in the spa world, I'll never forget, I worked for a group called the International Spa Association. In 96, we brought together a panel. Get this, it was such a superstar panel. Herb Benson, that you talk about from Harvard, the mind-body pioneer.
Right.
Andrew Weil, before I ever knew who he was. And one of my favorites, Larry Dossey. He's the prayer doc.
Yes,
and I know in one of your many interviews, you talked about the power of prayer. I mean, I'm such a groupie for Larry Dossey because he's a sweetie pie. And he said, you know, I was in Texas being a surgeon, and why were people praying all the time? What the heck? Was that making any difference? So he did what you doctors do and did the double blind study. And he was like, oh yeah, the outcomes are markedly better for people who are prayed for.
Right.
So how do you explain that with your spiritual background?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's complicated, the answer. When I reviewed the prayer studies for Cured, some studies report that prayer helps, some report that prayer does not help, and it's about an even split between the studies, and the more tightly constructed the study is from a traditional scientific standpoint, the less likely it is to show results for positive effect. Herbert Benson was awarded the largest grant to do a prayer study, so he did the largest prayer study that's ever been done, and the results did not show that prayer helped, and so it was very complicated, but my suspicion is that there's a big difference between people who are very advanced and skilled in prayer versus those who are not. And so that was not examined in the study, for example. And we know on the basis of meditation studies that when you do functional MRIs that look at how the brain is metabolizing certain nutrients in the brain, it's very different. The brain scan, the functional MRI is very different for advanced meditators than it is for college students who are just learning to meditate. And so that raises the possibility, and I suspect the likelihood, that those who are very advanced in the qualities of prayer is probably a really different deal. And so those prayers probably have much higher chance of going above the ceiling. So,
and what you were saying is some people just chanted like the same mantra in their prayer, which is not really a conversation. But
yeah,
that could take a whole half hour, that entire discussion, which I love so much. And now a word from our sponsor, the Miskawan Health Group. David, could you tell us, I read an article, we call it functional medicine today. How would you define functional medicine?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But I think functional medicine is really defined as bringing, as Dr. Wesley said, all aspects of a human being into the treatment program. So Dr. Wesley always likes to say that the best doctor is your own body. And he also likes to say that we are one organism. We're not a collection of parts. And I think that the way modern medicine has evolved, it's really given the time available to doctors and the clinical operations available to doctors and the options available to doctors for treatment, we basically, in many respects, are treating symptoms. So functional medicine goes back to, if you look at a medical almanac from, say, the 1930s, then you will see that for every ailment, there's a natural plant-based remedy listed there, which was usually quite successful. If you look at a medical directory from the current medical system, for every ailment, there's a chemical drug that's been prescribed. And I just don't think that in many cases that's the best solution for the individual. As Dr. Wesley said, it's based on guidelines, it's based on statistics. And in particular, now that we're global, the DNA of those of us who are, say, Caucasian is very different from the DNA of those of us who are Asian or from Africa or different parts of the world. And so you can't just apply clinical solutions that are good for Caucasians to everyone else. It doesn't work. So we plan to do a lot of our trials on people of Asian ethnicity because most of our operations are based in Thailand. So functional medicine to me, to answer your question in a long-rounded way, is just looking at a person as an individual and treating the function of that individual, the person as a whole being, to find out the reason why that person is not well and treat the reason, and so they become better. As Dr. Wesley said, it's not going to be the doctor that's going to fix you. It's going to be your own body that's going to fix you by having your immune system working as best as it possibly can.
Well, we're beginning to see the pieces fit together here. But David, since this was your idea, what need did you see in the health space for a place like Miskawan? And do you welcome the moniker of being a disruptor in the health system?
Yes. So after Dr. Wesley and I got to know each other for quite some years, I went to him, my wife and I went to him as a preventative medical doctor. I was in my 50s, going through male andropause and losing my vitality and my energy. And of course, after being treated, a lot of hormone imbalances and being on the planet for 50 years, a lot of toxins and pollution and everything like that building up. So now that at the age of 65, I have more vitality and energy than when I did 20 years ago at 45. So, but getting to know Dr. Wesley, I saw that he was doing a lot of great things on the curative side and helping people with very serious conditions. For the most part, doing things using natural substances or substances that are bioidentical to nature. And so that means that the body tolerates these substances very well. You know, if you're going to make a chemical drug, then you have to make a patent, you have to change at least one molecule. And by changing that molecule, you then find that the human body can't relate to that particular substance as well as a natural substance, hence we have negative effects or what we call side effects. So the ability to treat people using natural substances or bioidentical substances to nature is really important to Dr. Wesley. And it seems that people can recover. And you know, the core competency of Miskawan Health Group and Dr. Wesley is the immune system, to make one's immune system healthy and balanced and calm. And then you can fight off pretty much anything. So in terms of being a disruptor, I would definitely say that we are a disruptor. There's definitely a very important place, maybe the most important place in the world of medicine for modern medicine. And definitely, you know, we're not dogmatic. There's plenty of times when chemical drugs are required for the treatment of a patient. But I would say that most of the time, Dr. Wesley and our other doctors can find ways of treating people using natural substances that enhance the immune system and bring them back to full health. So we like to think of ourselves as disruptors, but we're not a big company. We're relatively small. And I think that one of the limiting factors is because we're treating people as individuals. You know, we, as you mentioned earlier on the podcast, we are offering individual precision medicine. So it's hard to globalize that because you're doing everything one by one. And one of our scientists, Dr. Rebecca Zirbel, who's a microbiologist and probably has forgotten more about cancer than most people ever know, you know, she always likes to say that there'll never be a cure for cancer because every cancer is different. So every single cancer is different from another one, and you won't be able to have a general cure. You've got to treat everyone individually. You know, we're going to be disrupting these kinds of things, and that, as Dr. Wesley said, we're not treating tumors. We're treating people with tumors in the case of cancer, for example. So in our own little way, we like to think of ourselves as disruptors.
Well, I don't know how little it is from what I've read. And what's so happifying for me, I'm in the catbird seat for wellness because I get to talk to so many people. But when I heard that you, your philosophy is to immune balance, to calm the immune system, to sort of hug it into a healthy place by the way you treat it, it really is in keeping with episode 44 of this podcast, which went deep into the trend that the Global Wellness Summit found for 2020, which was immune balancing, not immune boosting. So, gentlemen, yeah, it's so exciting to see these forward thinkers all agree. Dr. Redegar, many of your interviews begin with the origin story of your friend years ago who was an oncology nurse who got a diagnosis of terminal cancer. But yes, then she went to Brazil to a popular healer named John of God, if you translate it, who helped her disease go in remission. You tell the story of being skeptical and reluctant to believe that until you did evidence-based research. I need you to help us through this because anyone could Google that name and see all the controversy around it. But to me, many healers like John of God end up being discounted, even scorned by the medical community. And in his case, it looks like he eventually let his ego get in the way, which got him into legal trouble.
Right.
What conclusion have you come to about the role of so-called healers in these cases of spontaneous healing? Why isn't it just old-fashioned faith healing?
That's a great question. And I think it's complicated because I believe it's never really about the healer. I think that the healer is within us. And at their best, what happens is that external healer will help activate what's already within us. And so we have all these capacities within us that typically lie latent that we don't know how to activate. And that's why I think continuing to research and do this kind of work and what Global Wellness Institute's doing and really looking at these things more deeply is to begin understanding the powers and the possibilities of what does lie latent within us and what it means to activate those possibilities. So I think that's where it is. The healers themselves tend to be characters. I mean, they have these gifts, but they're also human beings. I mean, John, yeah, God, you know, he didn't know how to read or write. He dropped out of school in second grade, and then in his middle teen years was found to have all these capacities for healing. And so at a very young age was granted in a very patriarchal country, enormous power as a man, and didn't have anyone who ever, I think, held him accountable, and power for any of us. It doesn't matter whether it's in traditional medicine or the healing world or any of us. Unbalanced power or unaccountable power is dangerous. And so here's a guy, I mean, you know, my friends and I, we finished medical school in kind of a developmental moratorium because our friends who didn't go to medical school were getting married, buying houses, and living a more developmental trajectory. And you finish medical school after spending all these years studying instead of going out
living.
And you kind of, you have some things to catch up around developmentally. Think about how much bigger of a deal that would be for a guy who can't read or write, wakes up in his middle teenage years with all these powers granted him as this healer. And then this whole industry and town builds up around him with bringing people down from different places in the United States and in Europe to obtain healing, and Brazilians come and see him. And he's granted this almost demigod sort of status. And so he starts to act out sexually and that sort of thing, according to the reports and the alleged concerns. And no one's holding him accountable. And there's a lot of people's careers built around this. And so things can get out of control for any of us without accountability. And so I think you've got to remember, this is a human being. This is not someone, he's got these powers, but he's also a human being at the end of the day, like all of us are.
Yep. Dr. Bredinger, to go deep into your specific findings, you build an argument around four pillars of well-being: nutrition, healing our stress response, keeping our immune system healthy, and healing our identities. I love those, but let's break them down.
Yeah.
Nutrition. Let's start with back to the Amish, Dr. Bredinger. One of the basic building blocks of any body, of course, is nutrition. And I asked my sister, she worked in that Mennonite restaurant, which is like the more liberal sect of the Amish, right? I said, what was your favorite Amish meal? She said, okay, beef roast, green beans and homemade noodles, mashed potatoes with gravy, homemade stuffing, peanut butter cream pie, or date nut pudding with caramel sauce and whipped cream. Stab me. So tell me your finding. I mean, you had that sort of upbringing,
right?
But what are your findings about empty calories, the search for good food, all that?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal. You know, I was raised, like you said, I was raised with eating meat two or three times a day. I was raised with a lot of high caloric, but also foods that weren't processed. And that probably was really good for me. I didn't have the cold cereals with loaded with sugar. I didn't have a lot of the processed meats and that sort of thing. And that, in retrospect, probably was great. I mean, my parents sometimes would take the wheat, and they had a stone grinder, and they would grind the wheat that we had for our pancakes and our muffins and our bread. And that was fabulous and just not processed. A lot of the foods that we eat in the modern age are so highly processed that they are empty calories. And even though they may enrich them with a few vitamins and minerals, they are basically empty calories. And I think what happens is that our bodies know that our bodies long for the nutrition, the phytochemicals, the minerals and vitamins that the body needs to be at its best. And when you're in medical school, you memorize so many equations, the neurochemistry around what it takes to have a healthy brain and a healthy body. And you've got these critical vitamins and minerals at the key places of reaction in these equations. And so intellectually, you know, you're kind of learning that, boy, if you don't have the vitamins and minerals there, they're not going to go through to completion. But then, you know, doctors, we eat awful, and we're taught misinformation actually about what nutrition is, completely upside down training around that. And, you know, you go out to the nurse's station or whatever, and there's always cookies and pizza, or a pharmaceutical company has dropped off some kind of really high sugar content, low quality food that tastes great. And so you just learn these awful habits, and you work these long hours, and you're not taking care of yourself because you're so busy taking care of everyone else and your patients. And you know, the truth is you've got to have those critical vitamins and minerals there for those reactions to go to completion, or they're not going to go to completion. And that's in your brain and your body for so many of these reactions.
Oh, and so, I tell you, all you have to do to get really depressed is go into the Costco checkout line. Nothing against Costco's great deals, but people don't need to buy a tub full of bread or whatever it is that they're buying. It's very scary. So I love that you were courageous enough to bring green drinks and smoothies to your...
Yeah. I mean, years ago, that was kind of a thing. You would get made fun of, you know, you bring it to the hospital and there's a plate of brownies sitting there and people are going, you're going to drink that ugly green thing. And yet the funny thing is, and things are changing now a little bit, but you know, I eat a brownie now and usually it's just like, it tastes like chemicals, you know,
sugar bomb.
It's like, really? So what's the choice here?
I know. And one other thing you said is that cancer's favorite food is sugar.
Yes.
But there's even a glucose treatment to find cancer in the body, right? Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When you wanted to, if a doc is concerned about the possibility of cancer, they will inject radio-labeled sugar, basically a radioactive form of sugar into the bloodstream. And then if there's a place in the body that is sucking up that glucose, that sugar avidly and really sucking it up, I mean, that raises a real concern for cancer. And so more investigation is done. Cancer's favorite food is sugar. And so often we're taught that nutrition has nothing to do with what's going on in your body. That is just not true. So I can tell you story after story about what it means to change that whole trajectory. You know, 100 years ago, a little bit more than that, the average American ate 4 pounds of sugar a year, no big deal. Well, the average American now is consuming 154 pounds of sugar a year. And it's in everything. And our bodies were not made to metabolize that. And so these empty calories without the nutrients that our body longs for just triggers the hunger mechanism over and over and over again. So once I began to finally get it about what these people with remarkable recoveries were telling me about nutrition, and I began to reform my own life, I was shocked to see 40 pounds melt off my body without...
Wow.
I mean, these things really matter. And I wasn't hungry anymore. And I realized that, I wasn't hungry. I was addicted to sugar. And so everything changes. I'm not hungry anymore. I eat really well. My body is happy. So it's satisfied. It's just a different life. And I was a slow learner.
Well, a lot of us are. And also, I love that some of your patients also remember to eat for joy. Like,
yes.
Of course, if I can't have my red wine, I might as well not be alive. So I decide, don't eat the chocolate, have a glass of red wine, and things will be better. Anyway, let's go back to what we're talking about. Heal our stress response is one of your pillars of wellness. You said, especially in COVID, people were living in fight or flight. I have to tell you, when COVID first started, my husband works in a hospital. He works in IT. I was so panicked all day that he'd get sick. Yeah. That I had a coaching session with a nutritionist just as a test thing. And she goes, oh my God, Kim, you're really in fight or flight. You have to do yoga every day. And, you know, I really credit her with calming me the heck down because I really was. Woo! But I think the whole world was a little bit like that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's been so much trauma for people just because of COVID. And there's so much trauma that goes on in people's histories anyway. You know, the kind of things that people endure in their lives and the neurochemistry associated with that is something that we all need to be aware of. If a person is in chronic fight, flight, or freeze, that means that your body, your organs are being flooded with stress hormones way too much of the time. And so that means the brilliant cells of your immune system, all these brilliant cell subtypes that march to an infection, and they have all these specialized jobs and functions that we know on the basis of both lab research and clinical research that stress hormones cause them to misfire, to function incorrectly, to become sluggish. And then eventually they begin attacking the body that they were sworn to protect instead of the pathogen. And it's a massive amount of energy that gets diverted when they're fighting the wrong target and when they're attacking the wrong target. So it's a massive issue, and autoimmune disorders are escalating exponentially because of these issues. And it's a very different physiology when one is more relaxed when your brilliant immune cells are under the contribution from dopamine, the pleasure molecule, or or oxytocin, the love molecule, or serotonin, the antidepressant molecule. That's a really different physiology. And we know, both on the basis of very thorough lab research and clinically, once again, that that kind of physiology, your immune cells, they wake up, they begin to function properly. They attack the pathogen instead of the body itself. And so the difference between these two biochemical environments in our bodies are really important. So
yeah, and I keep thinking about the big peak in pet ownership, especially puppies and cats, right?
Right.
Since COVID, that is such a soothing thing for our fight or flight response. So I can't wait to study that more. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor, the Miskwan Health Group. But Dr. Vasoli, we will go into so many topics, but one thing that caught my eye was removing toxins from the body. How do you approach that at Miskwan?
Well, that depends on what kind of toxins you're talking about. First of all, we have to know what toxin is causing problems. So one of my many hobbies are the mitochondria. If a patient gets into a bad condition like fatigue, like the so-called fibromyalgia, which is just a nonsense. It's just a description of something. And it is not a disease itself. It has so many different reasons. Many times the mitochondria are the problem. And we have a lab which can take apart the mitochondria and see the single functions of the mitochondria. And we can even detect what causes the problem. Is it more a pesticide, or is it a fungicide, or it's a heavy metal, or is it this plastic softeners? You can see that in the mitochondria, and then we try to get it out in different measures. For heavy metals, is quite simple. You can have a chelation therapy, but with other toxins, it's much more difficult. This post-COVID problem is many times that viral proteins are blocking the mitochondria, and then you have to try to fix the mitochondria. We have a couple of therapies for that. One is hypoxia. That is, if the patient gets in the air he's breathing less oxygen, then the mitochondria or the that is a danger for the body. If there's not enough oxygen, the body will do everything to fix the problem. And that one of it is it degrades the old mitochondria and creates new ones. And so we can produce new mitochondria. At the same time, we have to detoxify the blood. Otherwise, the new mitochondria get the same toxins again. And so that means we strengthen the genes which are involved in detoxification, like SOD, GSTP, to work better. And at the same time, we try to build up new mitochondria, and that is quite successful. But of course, like always, we need a very thorough a diagnostic.
Before you can start that program, right? That takes us to our next point in your pillars, keep our immune system healthy. You know, it is magical what our bodies are programmed to do, but how can you apply this principle when we have a global pandemic and there are people who say, hey, I don't need a vaccine. I have a fabulous immune system. I never get the flu. I just don't get sick until they do. And 700,000 right. deaths in the US later. How do you make sense of those two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a person doesn't have, none of us do not have diabetes, heart disease, cancer, autoimmune illness, or lung disease. What a person really has is chronic inflammation. And so what we have misunderstood for so many decades in medicine is that it's not the problem with a particular organ, whether it's the heart or the pancreas or something like that. It's that for years, the way we eat, the way we manage our stress has been slowly building up this chronic inflammation in our bodies. And then once you have chronic inflammation, it's just a matter of time until one of your body parts breaks down and then others begin to break down at some point shortly thereafter or thereafter. And so the problem is the chronic inflammation. And you can take all the medications you want to treat that particular heart problem or pancreas problem, but if you're not healing the underlying chronic inflammation, you're still got a problem in your body. And so that's a whole different way of thinking. And diabetes is a chronic inflammation problem. Heart disease, chronic inflammation problem. Cancer, same. Depression, the same. Bipolar.
What? Depression is the same?
Oh, yeah. It's a chronic inflammation. And so you're going to be more susceptible to depression and anxiety if your brain is full of chronic inflammation. That leaves you more susceptible to depression and anxiety. When stresses come along or when you deal with certain losses, that's going to just make you more susceptible. And so these things are, it's so important that we begin thinking this way. And the fact that as docs that we are trained in body parts, you know, if you're interested in the heart, you become a cardiologist. If you're interested in the brain, you become a psychiatrist or a neurologist. And if you're interested in the gut, you become a gastroenterologist. By just focusing on the body parts all these years, we didn't see the forest for the trees, and the underlying issue is the chronic inflammation. So it's a very different way of thinking.
And that the head bone's connected to the foot bone, you know, it's all one body, right?
Exactly.
One of my favorite things you talk about is human connection. And, you know, that's one of the biggest topics that came up during the COVID shutdown, isolation versus the need for human connection. That's one reason we all want to meet together in Boston at GWS. But in listening to your past interviews, one thing you talked about, I just loved the vagus nerve. What is it? And what does it have to do with connection and well-being?
Well, yes. And so the vagus nerve is the super highway for the parasympathetic in our body. And so it's this massive nerve that goes through the center of our body from the brain down to all the organs and back again. And it is the superhighway that gets us out of fight or flight and into a more relaxed state. And it's a fascinating process because it's not just about being relaxed. It's also about connection, like you're saying. So in other words, that when your lips curve up into a smile, when you make really authentic eye contact with a person, whether it's the mailman or someone you really love, a friend of many years, it's the vagus nerve that's moving the muscles around your eye that helps you make eye contact and that puts a light in your eyes and helps you smile. That's the vagus nerve. We know that physiology of connection is fabulous for the immune system. And so, you know, so many people during COVID have been so isolated, and it's having genuine connection. Again, whether it's somebody that you don't know that you just meet briefly in the supermarket is while you're, you know, giving them your credit card or whatever, but an authentic connection that really lights up you smile, you make eye contact. That's wonderful for your physiology and for.
I better have a very active immune system because my friends get so mad at me. I'll talk to anybody. The grocery store checkout. We went to the LA Phil the other night. And we were so happy to be there. You know, everybody had to wear their mask, vaccine check, but we had our little cocktail intermission outside. And I started talking to a girl about her boots. And we became fast friends. I met her husband and her past as a dancer and what we thought of Tchaikovsky. And I was like, oh, that felt good. And then we went back in. You know, and that's what you're talking about, though. Spark it up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That your immune system loves that because, again, it's the love molecule, the oxytocin, the dopamine, the pleasure pathway. These things, your immune cells love those molecules.
Well, that's hopeful for me. Now, heal our identity. I mean, we save the best for last. This is so powerful. You admit it yourself is what touches your interviewers, the people that write into you. You say understand that there's something really friendly in the universe. We each have a deep value. How does that belief apply to your work in the mental health arena? And what have you learned from working with people with mental health challenges?
Well, I think there's something that's deep within all of us that doesn't rest until we experience unconditional love. And that's such an important thing. And ultimately, that has to come from within so that we I view self-love as a bank account. And if you keep taking out withdrawals to take care of everyone else, which many are trying to do, especially women a lot of times, and or those who are in the healthcare fields, so busy taking care of everyone else that you forget about what your own deeper authentic needs are and your own value and think that you exist just for the needs of others, you will eventually, we all become financially, we become bankrupt emotionally, spiritually, even eventually physically, and just washed out like a dry desert. And I think my friend Gabor Mate says, if you don't know how to say no, your body will eventually say no for you. And that is so deeply true. You know, I think that we need to be asking when we become ill, what is the message of this illness? What is this? What is it? Am I really depleted from giving too much to others and not paying attention to my own well-being, to the things that put a light in my own eyes? That's a big change. And, you know, I help people set up these selfish bitch projects because it feels selfish initially. But to set up a new life where you actually honor what your body needs, when you honor what well-being is for you, that feels really selfish initially. And it's not. It's just a misunderstanding. And so knowing how to invest in your own well-being so you create this surplus of well-being in us is that creates a wealth internally that bank account. You can just enjoy your life and enjoy people because you don't have to get something, you don't have to get love under the table when you're filled up with such well-being yourself. It's just a very different kind of life, and your body needs that, and so do our minds.
Well, you know, you have so many cases in your book that build an impactful conclusion in Cured. Here are two from my life that I think I'd love to get your feedback on. One is a friend's husband who was raised in the shadow of a bipolar father in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And even though the father left, the question was always, would he turn out like his father? And then seeing how her husband's life turned out, I mean, he worked all the time, he had nothing to show for it. He had high blood pressure. And he had a terrible diet on purpose. He wasn't dumb. He knew A plus B equals C.
Yeah.
But it felt to me he had a stroke actually in his mid-50s and sort of gave up and just deteriorated for the next dozen years to a very early and sad death. But my take on it is that it was his own self-loathing that was never healed. Why would you treat that wonderful body you have that way?
Oh, yeah.
And it allowed him to, that self loathing to rule his decision-making when it came to his own health. What's your thoughts on things like that?
Oh, I think that's it. I think that's why these people that I've been interviewing all these years, I mean, the thing, and they'll talk about the nutritional changes. They'll talk about learning what it means to heal their stress response and that sort of thing. But the thing that really puts a light in their eyes that they want to talk about is how grateful they are for the illness, for this life threatening illness, because it changed their relationship with themselves in a way that they experienced themselves and the universe so differently. It's shocking. When a person is given a life-ending diagnosis, the response is actually absolutely fear that they're going to die. And if they've been told they have 12 months to live, that's terrifying. But it's shocking how often a person's response is also more complicated than that. It's like, oh, wow, if I've got 12 months to live, I guess maybe I don't need to go to law school just because my dad's putting pressure on me to do that. Or if I've only got 6 months to live, I'm going to do what the hell I want to do with my life and not just please everyone else like I've been doing my entire life. And I'm going to do some things before I die. That paradoxically, that death of the false self can sometimes become a new life. And that new life, which is more authentic and more life-giving and not about pleasing others, that becomes a pathway into itself. And sometimes, and you can't predict, and there's a lot we need to do research around this stuff yet, but sometimes then time begins to go by and a person has a life for the first time. And it's an astonishing process to watch.
And I really encourage everyone to look at your Instagram page, Dr. Jeffrey Rediger. It is so hopeful. I mean, you put so, I don't know who's writing it for you, but pat him on the back. Maybe it's you. And, you know, we need hope. That's really, speaking of which, my second example is a really amazing friend of mine who was diagnosed at 32 with lymphoma. Many times he was told you have 3 months to live if we don't find something. But I asked him because he's taken to posting to Instagram tips because he's a survivor now, 9 years later.
But wow.
I said, what in the world did you do? How did you keep positive? And he said, you know what? I tried hard to keep my sense of humor, my sense of self, and to think of himself. He said, I wasn't the disease. The disease was a project that I was working on. And he said, of course, your reactionary mind takes over when you get bad news. But he would consciously work to shut that down and cling to his logical side and make his mind up to solve the puzzle. And he said something, but he said one thing is when he heard people say, I'm praying for you, it meant so much because he knew they couldn't help him physically with the cancer, but the thought to stop and pray for him. And he said, you know, his spiritual hope gave him stillness and solace. But he said one thing, even took something like flossing and brushing his teeth very seriously because he wanted to show his body that he cared for it. And he felt like they were in this for the long haul. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
And that's what you're talking about, right? Those are the kinds
of things. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's not just positive thinking and that sort of thing because a person, you know, having positive thoughts that are not fear-based or shame-based is critical. But if that effort to have positive thinking is built on a sea of unresolved grief and trauma and loss and unexpressed rage for things that have happened, that the positive thinking is not going to help. I mean, you got to deal with what a person has actually experienced, you know, what the traumas have been and what it means to heal that or to honor the feelings that one really has. And so it's a process, you know, each person's life and history of experiences really matters when it comes to healing a life and a body.
Well, you know what, Dr. Redegar, I could just talk to you all morning. It may be early here and I may need some more caffeine, but it has been so worth waking up to share your light with the world. And we just look forward to Boston. We're going to go deeper into the discussion. This is just a teaser to tell people what is in store. But really, we want to help you keep your light bright. Welcome to the spa and global wellness community because we're waiting for you. We're here to welcome you with open arms so you keep up that great work, okay?
You have a great energy. Thank you for interviewing me.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
We'd like to thank Dr. Redegar for a heartfelt, delightful, and oh-so-hopeful exchange, even if it was recorded in an hour when I'm not usually able to speak. I will tell you, though, my mind is still blown about that vagus nerve, and I do hope my vagus nerve is happy because of all this chatting and connecting I'm doing. If you'd like to hear more from Dr. Redegar and many other important voices in wellness, join us at the Global Wellness Summit, November 30th to December 3rd at the Encore Boston Harbor. And remember, there's also a way to attend the event virtually, which will be an interactive experience designed to make you feel part of all these important discussions. So check out www.globalwellness.com and click on register to find out how you can join us. Well, that's it for this episode. This is Kim Marshall from Swell the Agency. Can't wait to get together again.